Welcome to this morning's panel, the title of which is called Not Losing Sight of Financial Vulnerabilities. I think the operative word there is vulnerabilities. And before we started to discuss that, I thought we should focus on a different word, which is resilience, and to reflect on that word resilience, because it's the resilience of the last 12 months which I think has surprised us all, including myself. Last year, we had the second, third, and fourth biggest banking failures in US history. So that's three of the top four. And the Federal Reserve carried on raising interest rates. So in the space of something like 18 months, 2 years, the Federal Reserve has gone from QE to QT. We've gone from record low interest rates to interest rates at multi-decade highs. And in the United States, unemployment is still below 4%. Growth in the third quarter had something like a five handle. For the capital allocators in the audience, you all know high-yield spreads are still incredibly tight. Equity markets are a whisker away from all-time highs. And I think we all understand that the apparent resilience can always lead to complacency. So we have to ask the following questions, I think, on a panel like this one. Are there chronic risks accumulating beneath the surface? Were the banking failures of last year a warning sign of things to come? Was the LDI crisis in the UK really just a flash in the pan? So in some way, this panel, I'm calling the people on stage, and I hope they'll forgive me for this, the strategically paranoid among us. And we're going to talk to the strategically paranoid for the next 30 minutes or so. I'll save about 10 minutes for Q&A at the end. So if you've got any questions on some of the issues that have come up on this panel, please ask them. Any questions on some of the issues that didn't come up, I'll give you space for that as well. So let's get to work. I'm Jonathan Ferro, a news anchor at Bloomberg TV, and I'm pleased and very fortunate to say I'm joined by four esteemed panelists. We may well get a fifth one, so look out for a rock star entrance from Governor Kenyago, maybe towards the end of this one. Seated nearest to me is Lynn Martin, the president of NYSE Group. Then just alongside her is Lim Chow Kiat, the chief executive officer of GIC Singapore. Alongside Chow Kiat is Ronald P. O'Hanley, the chairman and CEO of State Street, and at the end there is Greg Jensen, the co-chief investment officer of Bridgewater. So just to begin this panel, I just wanted to open things up and give everyone the opportunity to respond to the following question, whether they are more impressed by the resilience of the last 12 months or more fearful about the vulnerabilities that may materialize over the next 12. Lynn, take it away.
Great question. It's nice to see you all this morning. It's nice to be back in Davos. I would say I am more impressed than anything at the resilience of the economy, but I'm also not overly surprised. When I look at, from my perspective, the financial market infrastructure that has been created that really holds together the global economy, it is something that has withstood multiple shocks. Now, at the New York Stock Exchange, we've been in existence for 231 years. We've seen multiple pandemics, we've seen multiple wars, and as a result of various shocks to the system, periods of volatility, financial crises, our financial market infrastructure has been honed to address the significant amounts of volatility. So if I think back to the last 2 years, not just 2023, but also 2022, there's been a tremendous amount of volatility in the system. And because our systems, not just at the New York Stock Exchange, but also the futures markets, the fixed income markets, the clearing infrastructure that underpins the global economy has been hardened and has been refined throughout those systemic shocks that we've experienced throughout history, it's not an overwhelming surprise that we have, from a financial markets perspective, withstood the significant shocks to the system very well.
Chakia?
Well, instead of impressed, I would say I was more relieved, right? That, a couple of those things that Lynn talked about didn't spill over. Because the way we looked at, I guess, financial vulnerabilities or some of the systemic risks is sort of through three lenses. First being negative shocks. We had a couple last year, right, especially on the geopolitical front. The second thing we look for is sort of the fragilities of the system. You look at typical things like leverage, liquidity, right, or pockets of stress, right? So that's the second thing, which I think the world still has quite a number of areas where that is not in good shape. And the last being complacency. It's a bit like Minsky's idea of stability breeds instability. So we have really enjoyed, you know, despite pandemic and other problems, we enjoyed actually more than a decade of very good financial market returns. So quite understandably, I think a lot of structures, a lot of investor positionings have probably been built on low interest rate, even zero interest rate. So, you know, with that sort of three lenses, we came into last year with real concerns. But as I said, it turned out, you know, to be a big relief, because I would give a lot of credit actually to many policymakers, whether it's in terms of containing inflation pressure, right? Of course, there's still a bit of a question mark of the longer term outlook, but at least in the last couple of months, we did see signs of improvement there, or in attending to acute issues, right? Like the regional bank problem. The authorities attended to the problem in double quick manner. I think that was very reassuring, that we might still have some chronic issue of sort of profitability being eroded in that system, but at least I think the market now has confidence that the sort of left tail, right, has been cut off by the forceful action. So that's how I would describe it.
Ron, please.
Yeah, I think relief is actually a good word. And if you think about how we entered 2023 after a period of extremely low interest rates, extremely active central bank intervention in the through quantitative easing into the marketplace, and knowing that that all was in the process of being unwound, I think there was a lot of breath holding going on. And you knew that something was going to happen. You just didn't know what that was. And, you know, we started to see casualties. I mean, I wouldn't describe what happened in March as a regional banking crisis. I would describe it as a crisis among some banks. There probably will be others, but it was interesting how the system itself actually held very well. And it did not turn into any kind of systemic problem. I mean, you had the regional banks in the U.S., you had the failure of Credit Suisse. In some ways, you know, in retrospect, when you look at them and the way they were managed and the way they were supervised, it's probably not surprising that it happened, but it did not turn into something systemic. I think the challenge for us now is, and I would also agree that policymakers have done an extraordinary job in terms of, if you think about the rate at which rates came up and the rate at which inflation is starting to tail off, it's not done. But I think that we should be pleased with policymakers. But there's an awful lot to be worked out still, right? Central bank balance sheets are still too high. Sovereign deficits are still too high. So we're in a moment where we should be, or at least I am, holding my breath as much about 2024 as I did about 2023.
Greg?
Yeah, I'm impressed and surprised. I think things worked out as well as you could have possibly imagined when we sat here last year. And I think, as you were just saying, that the risks going forward are a little bit of complacency, particularly in the U.S. There's no risk premium priced into hardly anything, which is because there's been so much liquidity coming out of the repo facility at the Fed that's been able to absorb the large budget deficit without other assets having to be sold. And that repo facility has been run down to a significant degree, and over the course of the year will likely run down to very low levels. So I think the extrapolating the liquidity conditions of last year, which were somewhat of a surprise, but when you add in how much money was in the repo facility and the decision by the Treasury to fund almost all on the short end of the yield curve created excess liquidity into a world that otherwise wouldn't have been, with essentially more than offsetting the quantitative tightening that you talked about. So I think the Fed's going to have to balance that as we go into this year. The liquidity from the repo facility is nearly gone. The choices on quantitative tightening and when to end it are going to become sort of important things, the hinge points in the next couple months. On top of that, you've got this extrapolation of the thing we're talking about. Are policymakers always going to be largely unconstrained and nearly perfect? That's sort of now what's priced in. The markets are pricing in the perfect conditions, lower inflation, allowing an easing without a recession. So we've got pretty much the perfect scenario priced in, which is both impressive and a concern going forward. And then you've got a world, particularly in the U.S., there are risk premiums across the world, but in the U.S., you've got a world with no risk premium and what we talk about is the two Cold Wars brewing, the Cold War with China and the internal Cold Civil War going on in the United States that's going to be playing out dramatically over the course of the year and has a lot of issues related to governance and the constraints on policymakers. And the last thing I'd say, while I'm super involved and super bullish on the power of AI, the easiest part of it is using it for destructive purposes. And I think as you enter this year, we'll probably see the most significant use of AI for destructive purposes. Both there's cyber security elements of that, there's political hacking elements of that, and the degree to which the power of AI has changed over the last year and a half, and the ease with which very destructive actions can be taken, I think makes it that 2024, you're probably going to see that. So in a world of perfect pricing, there's certainly a lot to think about.
So there's a ton to unpack there. So let's go through it piece by piece. So you've got the politics, elections. We've got Treasury issuance, which we can revisit in just a moment. And then you've got the Federal Reserve and investor sentiment, and we can do some AI a little bit later. Let's pick up on sentiment at the Federal Reserve, Greg. So I'll speak for the bulls in the room. This is what it sounds like. Disinflationary trends have emerged. There are no constraints on the Federal Reserve to ease if growth surprises to the downside. The Fed put us back. We're going back to low interest rates. Markets decided we'll get several cuts this year, maybe six. Is it that simple?
Well, I think if you have that much trust in the Fed, you'd say no, because the Fed is saying we're going to have three cuts. The markets are saying we're going to have six cuts. So the markets, I think the Fed's quite bullish on the things you're saying, okay, basically going to work out. We're able to bring down rates at a relatively healthy rate, given where the unemployment rate and all those consistencies are. And the market's extrapolating much further. So that's point one of the concern you have to believe. Now, the Fed is less optimistic than they ought to be. And I think when you look at the inflation picture and you diagnose exactly what's gone on, I mean, goods prices have dropped tremendously. That's brought down the inflation rate. Clearly, housing will continue in the inflation stats to come down. But the goods are starting to bounce. And unless you get a decline in wages, it's not sustainable to have 2% inflation and 4% wages. So one of those things is going to give. And the wages are acting as somewhat of a pull. So we think the last CPI report is somewhat indicative of what likely is the issue, which is inflation continues to fall, but it gets sticky in here, sticky around the wage level, maybe slightly below the wage level in the threes, making the Fed's job not quite so easy. Can they come off as fast as the markets think? And I think that's the risk, is the pivot's fully priced. To get more than the market's pricing for the interest rate decline, you probably need a significant weakening in growth, which is not discounted in the equity market, not discounted in the corporate spreads. So we think that's risky, and it's an example. If you go out the yield curve in treasuries, there's no duration risk premium priced in, and there's no credit risk premium priced in, and there's no earnings risk premium priced in. So those are all the things that we'd be a little worried about.
Ron?
Yeah, and I just building on Greg's point, there's still a whole lot of inflationary pressures left in the system. I mean, there was, again, Fed, other policymakers done a good job, but if you think about it, huge amount of fiscal spending still that's going on everywhere in the world, but you think about the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, yes, over time, perhaps that will actually reduce inflation, but it's all about spending. Secondly, you just don't have the same picture in China that we all expected. By the way, that was another thing in 2023. We all expected China to be a real kind of push to growth, and that hasn't materialized. And you do wonder what's going to happen in China, just economically. I'm not talking about politics. And then finally, demographics, right? We've gone from, in the Western world, from largely investing and saving to there's going to be this massive kind of retirement that's going to happen, and actually you're spending down things. All of that will put pressure, particularly on the long end. So I think that the challenge for the Fed and other policymakers are, we've stated to, how do we get to two? And this labor point is a really important one, because as we've deglobalized and as we've actually made it harder for migration to occur, particularly if you think about the United States, I mean, the United States demographic picture should look like Europe, and it hasn't, because for many, many years, it has liberal immigration. And that's gone. right? So the U.S. is going to look like the rest of the world is going to look like China. And so you do wonder where labor is going to come from.
Jackie, it begs the question, and I'll be the first one to use the word, transitory, which was toxic over the last 2 years. And I can tell you from daily programming at Bloomberg, that word is back. There are people with this renewed confidence that this period of inflation was transitory, that we have paid the price for raising interest rates from 0 to 5.5. We can move on. The phrase that I hear a lot in credit markets is survive till 2025. You know, low rates are just around the corner. This high inflation story is not here to stay. We're going back to the old world. Chowkiat, do you think that confidence is misplaced?
Well, I think Greg did touch on this, right? If you look at the composition of inflation and how that change or in terms of movement, you did see goods inflation, you know, taking a bit of a tumble. I think one can argue that that part of inflation indeed was transitory. The problem is the service side and things like wages, right? They look a lot more sticky. But I would also add on, you know, this point about expectation, right? Inflation expectation. I think that's, last year, I think the big relief was that did not tick up, right? Because if you start to have higher inflation expectation, it could turn into some sort of psychology. And that would be really difficult to unwind. I think the central banks should be given credit to be very forceful in preventing that from sort of being embedded. I mean, is the battle over? Not quite, but I would give them a pretty good report card. The second thing maybe to mention as investor, I mean, all this, of course, expectation and even prediction about inflation or interest rates are important, but not just by themselves, right? It's a question also of how much has been discounted. I think Greg made this point as well that actually a lot of good news has been discounted. So actually, if you don't share that good news, there's some opportunity, right? You could position the portfolio. That is a tricky thing, right? Even if you have a positive view on the trajectory, it's very hard to find value. It has to really outperform what has already been discounted. I mean, 250 basis points, right? That's a lot of cuts already priced in. So I think that's the quandary that I think for investors, you know, to deal with.
I want to pick up on something Greg alluded to, which is ultimately what would lead to a loss of confidence in the system. It wasn't the banking issues of a year ago. The Federal Reserve was able to contain some of that. Lynn, how do you think about that? What would ultimately test and lead to a loss of confidence in the system?
Well, I think, as my co-panelists have said, the financial market infrastructure has proven incredibly resilient, and I think the policymakers have done a fantastic job of mitigating the risks that they see in front of them. Importantly, they've been very disciplined about reacting to data and surprises, I would say. On data, inflation and jobless claims are certainly one area, but I think that they will, particularly as this year progresses, they're going to need to be very mindful of expecting the unexpected. Certainly, I don't know that any of us expected the conflicts that have arisen around the globe, particularly the ones last year, unfortunately. And given the interconnectedness of the global economy, I think it's incredibly important that they are mindful of reacting to the unexpected events that they do see in the system.
To some extent, there's already been some kind of celebration of the policy response. I'll call it a celebration. I think you've all endorsed what we've seen from policymakers. But when we talk about policymakers, aren't we just talking about monetary policy? And Greg, you suggested this, and you brought up the topic of Treasury issuance. What we've seen in Washington, D.C., in the White House, is arguably policy that has worked against the goals of monetary policymakers at times. The budget deficit is part of that story. Michael Semblist over at JP Morgan put out a year ahead piece at the start of this year, and he said the frog is boiling. And he referenced some CBO data that I'll share with you right now. The projections by the early 2030s are that all federal government revenues will be consumed by entitlement payments and interest on the federal debt. And as Michael points out, we've become accustomed to deteriorating finances without consequence. What are the consequences?
Yeah, well, I think the constraint, the only real constraint on policymakers, right, people could look at levels of debt and whatever, but the constraint when the rubber meets the road is inflation and currency weakness. And obviously, that becomes the question, is have we pushed it to the level where the inflation problem is a problem? Otherwise, if you can issue the bonds and you can get the buyers, like, if there's not an inflation problem, the Fed could be the buyer. So the limit, which I agree the in terms of the frog's boiling, like, we are going to press the limit. We're going to find it. There is some limit to the amount of proactive fiscal policy you can make without creating inflation. It's mathematically has to be the case. And it seems clear that no matter how the politics play out in the U.S., while it'll be different in the way it happens, the basic idea that we are going to keep pressing debt in the developed world in order to get growth, because without it, growth is too weak. The populist pressures keep building, which means we're going to find where that limit is. Now, will that take a year? Will it take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? But what's clear is the lesson right now for policymakers is more or less the easier the better. You can, if you're on the right, cut taxes. If you're on the left, increase spending. And those things are going to seem like we've clearly passed the ball. The next recession, the notion that you deal with a recession by writing checks rather than just through monetary policy is so strongly embedded, and in many ways for a good reason, because cutting rates has an effect on the financial markets and the top 1%, the writing checks obviously is less regressive in that sense, a way to ease. And that's happening, and that's going to happen until you hit the wall. And there was certainly the risk that we hit the wall, in that we learned where the wall was in 2021, 2022, but it turns out that actually the medicine to deal with that wasn't too bad. And so I think you're going to see that fiscal policy is super powerful in generating nominal GDP growth. And until that's dominated by inflation, you're going to continue to press that limit.
What does that day look like? Can I ask? Because we often talk about this, and the answer that I get is some sophisticated version of wait, we'll hit the wall eventually. Which, as you know, when you have conversations with people that are investing, it's not very helpful. So what does it look like?
That day? Well, I think you'll see it when, I mean, I think this is the thing we're talking about, right? Does inflation continue to fall? You take a country like the UK, where probably the currency risk is high to these policies, right? That they actually have to attract the capital. They've, in many ways, cut themselves off from accessing capital by moving out of the European system in a certain way. So I think in different countries, you'll see it in more currency crises, and you'll see it in inflation if you take the U.S., and then you have constrained policymakers. And that's where the real crisis hits, right? Right now, we all know something bad happens, the bank problem in the U.K. We know it's easy to print money. It's hard to deal with inflation as a policymaker, because particularly when inflation and growth are going in opposite directions. So that's when you'll see the real risk emerge, in my mind, because right now, also political situations can change the governance of the policymakers. You think about who will be Fed governor if Trump wins the presidency. It's going to be educational for us. We're going to learn some untraditional things, and that's the but otherwise that'll be the constraint. So what that'll look like is inflation rising with growth falling. That'll be the end game of the huge cycle we've been in since the 1980s, which is lower interest rates, more and more unconstrained policymakers, able and becoming more, having better tools to deal with liquidity crises, to deal with growth crises. And the lingering issue is, if you have to deal with a currency or an inflation crisis, the tools are much more painful because they go the opposite way from growth.
You've mentioned politics a couple of times now, and I've warned our audience. I did a panel earlier this morning on private markets, and I asked the panelists about the election in 2024. They did not want to discuss the election in 2024. I'm hoping that we'll get some more engaged responses from you guys. Chowkia, you frame financial risk as financial risk within the system and financial risk from outside the system. Where does the 2024 election feature in the United States for you?
It will be in the first category, negative shocks. Right, there's some sort of, maybe not in 2024, 2025, right, with the new administration or whoever is in charge.
We're assuming there'll be a new one.
I'm not saying that. It's too difficult. It's too difficult to make that prediction. But you just have to kind of put at the back of your mind there's that possibility, right? That 2025 maybe a year that you see very big shocks coming out of the system?
I think that the biggest uncertainty and the potential biggest shocks are as much outside the United States as they are in. I mean, I think there's probably an argument that that a new Trump administration, there's plenty of people that will argue that it could be fine for U.S. economics. But I think the uncertainty that's, I mean, you feel it here. I've been feeling it for the last year about what does it mean for U.S. foreign policy. I mean, listen, we've got a very, very important set of conflicts going on that we've got to resolve. The Ukraine conflict, the broadening conflict in the Middle East. And it's just to have a rapid change in American foreign policy, particularly amongst its allies, I think is the great uncertainty out there and something that we all have to reckon with.
Lynn?
Well, I think it's important to not lose sight of the fact that in 2024, there will be the most elections in the Western world in history. So more than 60% of the world's GDP, resulting in more than 50 million people are going to go to the polls. If anything, over the last couple of years, it has proven the interconnectivity between our nations, between the economies of our nations, and how something that someone does in the UK affects what happens, monetary policy in the US affects monetary policy in one of the APAC countries. So I wouldn't want to lose sight of the fact that there are a tremendous amount of elections around the globe taking place this year. It's almost a resetting of the table. So I think it's really important to look at the effects of all of those elections and what the global economy and global geopolitical environment looks like following the elections this year.
So we started this conversation at the World Economic Forum a little bit earlier this morning, and I'd like to build on it in this panel. Regardless of who wins the election this year, it's pretty obvious what the direction of travel is for things like globalization. Chowki, I'd like your thoughts on deglobalization, but not from the perspective of industry, from the perspective of capital markets. It amazes me that I speak to investors on any given day who speak with such ease and comfort and say things like, from a US perspective, China is now uninvestable. Which is somewhat unthinkable that the world's second largest economy in its capital markets is somehow uninvestable to the Western investor, particularly those in the United States. I understand that you personally don't share that view, but how do you see those forces, that tension, evolving over the next 12 months?
Well, that what you describe as direction of travel is I'm in agreement with that. You know, it gets more and more fragmented. We already have seen, right, in quite a few areas, supply chain in particular, technology as well. I think that trend is probably not reversible. I think Ron touched on, right, you might say the structural picture of that is structural, right? So you have to plan for at least 10, 20 years of this trend. That the implication is not great. For investors, for sure, right? I mean, there's already an implication for inflation, which will eat into return, real return, right? That's what we care about. But I do believe that many businesses are sufficiently agile, right, to be able to sort of pivot and navigate. Same for investors. It's no longer, I guess, that same playbook that one could use, you know, maybe for the last 25, 30 years. There has to be a new playbook, agility, you know, sort of be able to make changes along the way. I think that has to be, I guess, a skill, a capability that everybody has to acquire. But really hard to see, you know, what eventually that structure is going to be. You just have to have the ability to navigate, you know, as you move towards that.
Greg, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, like you said, you're seeing the implications of the deglobalization of the financial market, which is what you're asking about. I think in the arbitrageability of interest rates across the world, you got, and that U.S. investors saying, let's say China's uninvestable, simultaneously, China's not investing in the U.S., and the flows were going the opposite direction. I mean, China invests a lot more in U.S. risk-free rates than the other way, and now, while China's not selling, really, they've shifted a little bit, but they're not buying. And this changes the global financial system, and you're seeing that other places, too. Basically, the weaponization of the dollar is also a trend. So basically, the U.S. saying part of the power is going to be using the dollar. That changes the money coming into the U.S., and, of course, the geopolitical conflict and the risk goes the opposite direction. And you're seeing that, I think, in the reason U.S. real rates were able to get as high as they were is in part because there isn't the global arbitrage there was. You look at Japanese real rates, you look at Chinese real rates compared to U.S. real rates, the divergence is quite significant and probably more sustainable divergence because the liquidity won't travel around the world just as goods are starting to be. And it's also interesting when you look at what's priced in for companies that are dependent on the supply chain in China versus those that aren't, there isn't much of a risk premium there either. And I think that that's under discounted, underpriced, that while probably things will work out okay, and certainly the Biden administration and looks like China right now, we're in a little bit of we have the bad secular trend, but a cyclical easing of conditions by Biden hoping to get through the election without a blow up here. But we're probably going to be back on track. And any small thing, again, U.S. politics is such that 83% of Americans see China as a big negative. Like, it's the most popular thing you can do in the U.S. is do something anti-China. And so the likelihood that as you get into election that this thing flares again, any small thing sets off a trigger of events because neither party could be seen as weak on China. And the fact that the pricing isn't pricing in the risk, that the real clamp that China has on the U.S. in the reverse is making it hard to utilize the supply chains through China, which are still mission critical to some major U.S. companies.
I wanted to save some time for questions from the audience, so I'm going to save 10 minutes for that. You gave us a list of things to work through at the start. I believe it was monetary policy, treasury issuance, politics, and the fourth one was AI. So let's deal with AI. Mm. It's a perfect question for you, Lynn. Mm. How are markets going to confront what could be a brand new era of misinformation driven by AI?
I would say, nice easy question there.
Super easy to finish.
I would say that the way you're going to see it manifest itself is volatility and seeing price swings throughout markets. AI is a data-driven trend. If you've got good data in the large language models, natural language processing, whatever the case may be, you're going to get good outcomes. If you've got bad data in there, you could result in a significant amount of volatility being introduced into the system.
The title of this forum is Rebuilding Trust. Ron, how do we rebuild trust in new technology?
You know, I mean, it's a very good question, and I'm just thinking back to, I think it was last week, right, when somebody hacked into the SEC yep. website, and the next thing you know, there was a spike in Bitcoin. Yep. And that wasn't even AI. That was just a simple hack.
Someone on Twitter just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think, I mean, what we're seeing is, and it's been occurring now for the last almost 30 years, it's the democratization of tools. And democratization usually is a good word, but it also means that anybody, good actor or bad, has these tools. You know, we saw it with, starting just with the ability to, in your hands, in your phone, to be able to access the internet and do whatever you want. And now you've got this democratization of these tools that, to the point made earlier, is probably going to be used in the short term more for bad things than for good. Now, having said that, there's an enormous amount that can be done. I think I'm actually a believer that this will unleash a lot of new productivity. Productivity has been lagging in the developed world now for a long time. This will unleash that. But the protections that need to be put in, we can't even contemplate what those are. And we're not even talking about, right, the advent of quantum computing. You've now got all this data that's been stolen and warehoused. I mean, probably everybody in this room has lost data, and it's encrypted, and it's sitting in some bad guy's warehouse. But quantum brings along the ability to unencrypt it. And so 10 years from now, you'll find that account that, you know, you didn't even remember you had is being used against you. So this is actually something, And we need to, at least in the United States, we need to rethink the relationship between the private sector and government on this. You know, we kind of left this to the private sector early on. That has swung back, and there's much more of a partnership. But ultimately, if you think about this, there needs to be a very, very clear framework out there in terms of how this is going to work, and it's not present yet.
We have got a bit of time for audience questions, so if anyone would like to ask any questions potentially about Donald Trump being the next president. I think Davide at the back there.
Thank you. I have a question for the audience. Few of you said that policymaker did an outstanding job. As a banking specialist, I actually saw a total collapse, because last year we had the fourth largest U.S. banking crisis, and de facto the U.S. Treasury had to break the golden rule, which is above $250,000, your deposits are not protected, and say, hey, don't worry, everyone is guaranteed. And as a result, 100 years of history thrown out in a weekend. So why is this such a great result? Because you created the biggest moral hazard ever.
Who would like to answer that one?
Yeah, I'll take that. I think most of the references to policymakers were actually to central banks. And I think the central banks, in terms of their response to inflation, and I think that they've done actually a pretty good job with a lot of uncertainty. This was untrodden ground in terms of what they had to do. I agree with you in terms of, I think Treasury had to do what it did at that moment because, again, going back to, we had, in my mind, some poorly managed banks and under-supervised banks that was now being characterized and the fear being that it was going to turn into a financial crisis. Memories are still short going back to 2008. I think the Treasury and the policymakers understood that, listen, you had three banks that didn't seem to understand how to manage interest rates, but they recognized that the contagion risk here was very, very severe. So they did that. That's also what led to the 10 largest banks in the U.S. banding together and saying, listen, we're going to put a deposit into First Republic. We went in as an unsecured depositor, basically pari passu with everybody else, really to restore that confidence, restore that trust. And I think this is the challenge that we're in now because memories are very, very short. This had nothing to do with 2008. It didn't look anything like that. It's too bad that it got magnified to the way it did, but something had to be done. It also didn't help that coincidentally, in the same week, and it was a coincidence, that Credit Suisse finally met its demise. So I think with everything going on, it was something Treasury had to do.
Would anyone else like to respond to that? Greg? Chao Kia?
Yeah, I would say it's a kind of balanced scorecard, right? I would say the responses, the recovery was very good. But could they have prevented? I mean, that I would say yes as well.
Yes.
Any other questions in the audience? Down at the front here.
Hi. The dollar, weaponization of dollar has been mentioned earlier, right? But what about weaponization of other currencies and more fragmentation occurring across currencies? So basically, de-dollarization. What impact, maybe not in the short term, but in the medium term, do you see on the markets?
Yeah, happy to take that. I think that it's likely that you'll have that the split, because basically the dollar strength was everybody felt comfortable saving in dollars. That's in the end the main thing about the dollarization around the world was everybody saw it as safe. Everybody was willing to save in it. Now you're seeing that balkanization, and where is it safe to save? And when most of the savings in the world is in Asia, it's really like where, and to some extent the Middle East, where will they save is where the dominant currencies will be. And I think it is likely to be a multipolar world in multiple ways, multipolar in terms of the military, economic strength, and currency strength. Of course, the good thing for the dollar is there's no reasonable alternative. There's nothing where everybody says this makes sense for me to save it. But you are seeing this movement. You're seeing the movement of, okay, so you've got dollars for certain allies, perfectly good. You've got gold for more central banks making sense because you don't have a, you don't, there's not somebody on the other side. You've got Bitcoin making sense for entities that are concerned about governments generally. And maybe, and I think you will see regionalization of whether it's the Chinese currency and others picking up some parts of it, and that world savings will be more distributed, which going back in terms of impact on markets, I think that means less arbitrageability of interest rates, harder to get capital from places where there are less purposes to it. So you're seeing lower productivity in the distribution of capital, just as you'll see lower productivity in the distribution of goods as you sort of divide the as you divide up the world in that way.
We've got time for one more question down here.
Yeah, what do you think of the electronization of the yuan and China trying to go to a full electronic currency? And what do you think about whether the U.S. and other modern economies should do that, or Western economies?
Anyone want to take that?
Go ahead.
I mean, I'm happy to talk about the U.S. I think there's... I don't think you're going to see it in the short term in the U.S. I think the Fed is not really crazy about it. I think for a number of reasons, not least of which is that banks are an important transmission mechanism for monetary policy, for interest rates monetary policy. And so to the extent to which you're actually, depending on how it's implemented, but if you're completely cutting the banking system out of that, I think it becomes a question of how that's going to work. I think more likely the way you're going to see this evolve is almost in a hybrid sense, that you'll have kind of traditional financial structures paired with digital structures, because there's lots of reasons to move towards real-time payments. I mean, if you think about, this is now, I'm getting into Lynn's world, so I'm sure I'll get it wrong, Lynn. If you think about settlement in the movement towards faster and faster settlement times, which is better for the financial system. Well, if you're going to go to instantaneous settlement, you need to go to instantaneous payment. So I think you'll see those kinds of hybrids, so if you will, wholesale payments. But I think in the short term, and it also seems to be losing interest, but in the short term, I don't see it for true kind of retail banking and those kinds of things. But
yeah, I think politically there's this battle, right, that's happening differently in different countries between the power of centralization and some of the productivity benefits that implies, but obviously the privacy and control concerns, where China's obviously on the cutting edge of not overly worrying about the privacy and the decentralization. So basically, if you look at that kind of government-controlled electronic currency combined with AI, the centralization of power is happening so quickly, you've obviously got pressures in the West on the other side of that, political pressures on privacy, political pressures on decentralization of these things, with, like, obviously kind of cryptocurrency blockchain being the opposite side of the extreme opposite side of the centralization. And that's what you're seeing played out, and I think it's going to play out country by country, and countries with more concerns about individual choices and privacy, that's going to be a much slower thing. It can run alongside. You get more and more electronification of currency, for sure, but digitization of currency, I should say. But it won't. It certainly won't take on this whole thing because of the push on privacy and decentralization.
I'm going to break Swiss law and go over by about a minute to give Lynn the final word on this. If we've got 20 seconds, but
yeah,
the floor is yours.
I want to touch on something Ron said. I think last week there was obviously a lot of interest in Bitcoin ETFs coming live through the heavily regulated SEC framework. But the one thing that, and the one story that I think may have gotten missed, is something Ron said. It's the settlement of the underlying basket of those securities. For the first time, the settlement of the underlying basket has a shorter time horizon than the wrapper itself. So ETFs settle T+2, about to move to T+1. Bitcoin, the underlying basket of that ETF, has instantaneous settlement. So I think the hybrid structure, as Ron said, I think that's something that's going to bear watching, given the new technologies that are emerging. I think Bitcoin ETFs, from a technology standpoint, not speaking about the currency itself, from a technology standpoint, I think that's going to be very instructive to see how the financial systems continue to get modernized using good technology.
Interesting. I'm not sure how much trouble I get in for going 90 seconds over, but forgive me, Switzerland. To all of you in the audience, thank you for being with us. I think we all wish you a wonderful week here at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. If we could have a round of applause for our fantastic panelists.